KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, Greg Milner traces the history of GPS, the global positioning system, which is everywhere these days. Smartphones, computers, cars, ships, planes. GPS tracks the movement of animals, criminals. It measures subatomic particles. It predicts the weather. It can sense glaciers melting. And Milner says GPS has become so dependable, so ordered, so clean, it's become our heartbeat. But, and this is a big but, there is a price. He says GPS could be changing us, actually rewiring our brains. Today in the program, Milner is joining us to explain the risk in letting a system do all the cognitive work. The book is called Pinpoint. Join us after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West's podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, providing wealth management to the Intermountain West for over 30 years. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're going to understand the effect of GPS on the world, which is what Greg Milner does in his new book, then you have to understand how we used to orient ourselves in the days before we had a sophisticated system embedded in everything. One of the fascinating parts of his book is how primitive Polynesian navigators made their way in the world. As Milner explains it, these navigators used astronomy and oceanography and meteorology, but it was more than just memorized knowledge. As he explains it, it was a way of conceiving space. The Polynesians charted a course using a whole worldview. But at some point along the way, we all turned to something else to get our bearings, a kind of self-centering. And that's where we are now with this ubiquitous system that Milner says has become our heartbeat. Today in the program, Greg Milner is joining us to talk about his book. It's called Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. Milner is a former editor at Spin magazine. His writing has appeared in The New York Times, Wired, Rolling Stone, among other publications. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Greg Milner, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
What got you started thinking about all of this? Did you get lost, or was there some particular moment? What happened?
Well, it was mainly that a few years ago, I started to notice that, you know, there was this thing called GPS that we all used seemingly in one way or another, and nobody, myself included, seemed to know what it was. It was around the time when it was migrating onto our phones, and it just seemed to be everywhere. And I just started to wonder what it was, whether it was an actual specific thing or just a general way, you know, means of navigation, and who was behind it. And so I took off from there. And just when I thought I knew all there was to know about it and how much it was used in our world, it was like peeling an onion. You know, there'd be another layer, and I'd realize that there was a whole different level of GPS use that I was unaware of.
Yeah. At what point did you figure that the story wasn't just about this really interesting technology, but also about the sort of implications, you know, the effect of this technology?
Well, it was around the time when I just started to realize how much we were all depending on it. You know, there was a moment actually in a few years ago where an image showed up on Google Maps Street View of a man lying in the street at this corner of 29th and Park Avenue South in New York City in Manhattan. And no one knew where it came from. And once people started to notice it, Google pulled it. But the image survived. And I started to think about how weird it was that there was this image of a man lying in the street that we knew nothing about. But somehow GPS was implicated in this, the fact that we were privy to this incredibly, probably intimate moment in a man's life, maybe even his last moments. But we didn't really know anything about him. And that just started to make me think about, like, well, what is GPS doing to us? Like, how are all the ways it's really changing the way that we see the world?
I want to come back to that story, actually, this story about fallen man, because you saw the photo in 2009, and then you kind of track it down, and you raise this bigger question, which we'll get back to, about kind of how we perceive reality. And I wanted to ask you just generally right now, because you say this system could fundamentally change us as human beings. So we'll get to the details as we go, but give us a broad sense of what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, essentially what GPS does is it has an effect on what psychologists and cognitive scientists call the cognitive map. Now, that's basically our ingrained sense of where we are in the world and where we exist in relation to other things. It's what helps us do what's called wayfinding, figuring out how to get from one place to another and where we exist in that world. Anybody who's used GPS, you know, on a, say, in a strange city while driving through it, knows that you need to know almost have no very little situational awareness whatsoever.
Yeah.
You really don't need to know anything about where you are. You just listen to that voice. And so that has a fundamental effect on our cognitive map because it makes us less reliant on it. We just have to listen to the directions. I mean, there's a term coined by the park rangers in Death Valley, California, called death by GPS.
Yeah.
And what that refers to is people who are following their GPS so blindly that they wind up in trouble. They maybe don't use common sense. They just figure GPS knows where to take them, and they get into, you know, into really bad situations. And part of that is because I think we're just not relying on this cognitive map anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, there may even be evidence, it's too soon to say, that it could even be changing, you know, having a neurological effect, actually changing our neurochemistry. That's a little too early to say, but there is an increasing amount of evidence that it's changing the way we view the world in terms of the way we interact with our own cognitive map and how well developed that map is.
Yeah. All right, we'll get back to that. Let's explain, as you sort of started out in this process, to describe what it is, GPS. And you begin the book at Schriever Air Force Base in Colorado. And what they do, as one of the people there tells you, is they do space. They monitor and they maintain this big system.
Yeah.
It's 31 satellites, basically, and pretty expensive to maintain every year.
Right. I mean, the GPS is essentially, you know, three different segments. The first is the space segment, which is the satellites, 24 active at any given time, that are arrayed in such a way where from any spot on Earth, just about, you have a line of sight to at least four of them, and they orbit about 20,000 kilometers above the Earth. The control segment is Schriever Air Force Base, where, you know, it's the master control station for GPS, as well as a handful of monitoring stations scattered around the world that monitor the satellites as they come over the horizon, make sure they're exactly where they're supposed to be, and send all that data back to Schriever. And then there's the user segment, which is us, every single one of us, the billions of GPS receivers that exist now in the world.
It's interesting the journey the signal takes. It's like 12,000 miles,
yeah.
And it takes 67 milliseconds.
Yeah, about that, give or take.
Right, give or take, yeah. But it's interesting that give or take is interesting because you mentioned just in terms of, let's just talk about like digital trading.
Yeah.
Give or take could cost someone millions of dollars.
Absolutely. And in terms of coming up with a position fix, you know, if you're off by even a fraction of a second, it can tell you that you're, you know, miles and miles, maybe even hundreds of miles away from where you think you are, because the entire system is based on timing. I mean, at root, what GPS is one of the world's most accurate clocks.
Yeah.
Every satellite's got several atomic clocks on them, on it, and they're all synchronized with one another to within nanoseconds, because the way GPS works is basically your receiver, whether it's, you know, a sophisticated GPS receiver or the simplest chip in your phone, is measuring how long it takes that signal to travel from the satellites to you.
It's a navigational satellite system, and there aren't very many of them because they're expensive to put together. Russia
yeah.
has one. It's kind of dodgy at times, but
yeah.
they've got a decent one. China has one. At least they're developing one that's pretty good. But it's the American, I guess, GPS system right now that's sort of the center of everyone's attention?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most amazing things I learned about GPS that I really had no idea was that GPS is used by everyone everywhere. It's available
yeah.
for free to anyone in the world. I like to say that when an ISIS terrorist gets a position fix on his phone, he's doing that courtesy of technology from the Pentagon.
Right.
Because it's being provided by, it's owned by the United States federal government, controlled by the Department of Defense, and administered daily by the United States Air Force, and they reserve parts of the signal for themselves, but the other signal, the civilian signal, is used by everyone everywhere.
What happens if it fails? Like tomorrow it failed, because you say really, and with a system like this, we're at the point where there's really no room for error.
Yeah. I mean, what people really worry about, I mean, there's two basic ways to mess with GPS. Right? The first is jamming the signal, and that's sort of self-explanatory. You make it so the signal isn't there, and that can have very bad consequences. For example, out here in the East Coast on the New Jersey Turnpike freeway, when it goes past Newark Airport, for a while there were so many little blips from portable jammers that people like truckers carry in their trucks so that they can't be tracked by their bosses, that it was shorting out the landing system, the GPS-based landing system at Newark. The much more dangerous way, though, that GPS could be interfered with is called spoofing. Yeah. And that's when someone in an area sends out a phantom signal that convinces GPS receivers nearby that it's the GPS signal when it's really not. And they start to treat it as though it were the GPS signal. And the reason that's particularly bad is that GPS is used for timing even more than it is for navigation. It's a way to synchronize complex systems that spread over large geographical areas that rely on precise timing, like, for example, the electrical grid or financial transactions or mobile phone communications. So if, say, one tower in a mobile phone system, relies on a spoofed GPS signal and it gets its timing a little bit off, that can affect it the way it sends the calls from one tower to the next, and so it can have a kind of chain reaction. So the real fear is not that the entire system going down. That's unlikely to happen. Those satellites are very far away, and you need a way to take them out, or you need to infiltrate Schriever Air Force Base, and I've been there, and good luck with that, because they have posters saying that they can use deadly force on anyone that they think is a threat to that room. But it's these localized outbreaks of errors that really scare people and that governments are really starting to take seriously. I mean, GPS has spread so fast that it's become entrenched in our world almost before we've even thought about the consequences of that and figuring out how to protect it.
The delicacy of the system really struck me. You write, a timing error of just 1/1,000,000th of a second will translate into a distance error of 200 miles.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. That's all it takes, just a small fraction of a second.
And you say that something as subtle as the pressure of the sun's rays can shift the orbit of a satellite. You have to take into account Einstein's theory of relativity. I mean, this is really precise.
Yeah, a GPS is probably the only system created by human beings, except for maybe particle accelerators, that has to account for Einstein's laws in order to operate, because those satellites, they're not moving at the speed of light, but they're moving fast and they're far away, so time is passing a little bit different for them as it is for us. So again, your chip in your phone is taking that into account, is taking relativity and considering its effects when making its calculations.
One of the most fascinating parts for me about your book was the section where you examine how it is we did all of this, how we navigated the planet before something like GPS, and not just the functional part, but how different cultures in another time perceived the world itself. And you focus on primitive Polynesians. I wanted to spend some time with this,
sure,
with this section. The Polynesians, we should say right off the bat, were pretty amazing, pretty remarkable, kind of about extending their reach. It was it was an immense accomplishment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Pacific accounts for about 1/3 of the globe. You know, every piece of land in the world could, if it was fused together, could fit within the area covered by the Pacific. And it's got these little tiny, basically rocks scattered through it. And over a period of long period of time, the Polynesians found it, and they almost certainly did not find it by drifting aimlessly. That's almost an impossibility. I mean, they've done computer modeling, and that's almost certainly not the case. They did it because they had a way to conceive the world that allowed them to very slowly but steadily branch out into that ocean and not only find new places, but be able to go back and forth between the new places and the old places.
Mm. Let's talk about some of the basics first, and then get to some of these navigators, one in particular that you explore in the book. A Polynesian navigator you mentioned had some tools, and one of the most important was this, I'm not sure if I'm going to get the pronunciation, was it sidereal?
I think sidereal.
Sidereal compass, yeah. Explain what a sidereal compass is. It's not a physical thing. It's kind of a mental capacity.
Right. It's essentially a mental image and memorization of the stars in the sky and how they move and where, and how to use them. It was learned over, you'd start when you were very young, and it would take years and years to master it. And they would do things like, I think, probably make maps on the sand with pebbles to try to learn it. It wasn't a compass in the physical sense, like something you could hold in your hand. It was more something you held in your mind.
But the thing, and this is what I was getting at in the introduction there, you say that the Polynesian navigators had this thing that was really difficult to describe or explain. It's they had a world view.
Yeah.
How do you think you understand that now?
It took me a while. Yeah. I mean, I understand it a lot better now. I mean, basically what that worldview comes down to is that they saw islands as not as basically moving. What I mean by that is if they were going from island A to island B, they would pick another island, island C, to use as the reference point. And they couldn't see island C. Of mm-hmm. course, they couldn't see island B either. Yeah. But they knew island C was out there, and they knew where it was in relation to where they were now. And as they moved through the ocean, you know, they knew the routes to take because they had the sidereal compass and other clues that they could glean from wind and swells and things like that. They also, the way they kept an image in their head of where they were was by the system of reference islands. Mm-hmm. And the way they saw it, it was the islands that they were moving, and they were standing still, or being still in the ocean, and essentially letting the islands move by them. It's a crazy way, it seems to us, to see the world, because it basically sees the world as not set, you know, it's spatially as being contingent on where you are in relation to other things.
Yeah.
Whereas we, of course, think of ourselves as, because we use latitude and longitude, as existing by that system. That, like you said in the introduction, it's called a self-centered system, because right. we only define it in relation to where we are. They did something a lot more subtle and complex in a way, in that they defined themselves always in relation to where they were vis-a-vis other islands.
Let's talk about two of these navigators in particular. The first is a man named Tupaia.
Tupaia.
The famous British sea captain James Cook meets him in 1769.
Yeah.
And he has this map of the Pacific that was it was confusing, baffling, I think, for sort of some people, but it was really sophisticated. And the thing, the sort of part about this story that's so interesting is Cook doesn't really pay much attention to this way of thinking.
It was kind of amazing. I mean, Tupaia was a brilliant guy, you know, brilliant navigator, basically, you know, hitched a ride aboard Cook's vessel because he got into some trouble in Tahiti and needed to get out.
Right.
And he drew this map that really made no sense to Cook. And it took people years and years and years to figure out what he was doing. And what he was doing was this kind of heroic attempt to fuse the Western way of looking at the Pacific, you know, in terms of like a Cartesian set of coordinates with this idea that I was just talking about of islands kind of only being defined in relation to where they were, depending on where you were at that moment. It was a really confusing map, and he did a very, very good job. And I think to Cook, it just was meaningless. It just meant nothing to him because Cook was already on this sort of this track that we still do now, this sort of self-centered way to look at the world. I mean, Cook was sailing at a time when they were trying to figure out how to invent a chronometer, you know, a clock that could keep very accurate time about aboard the open oceans. And the reason they did that is because they needed that in order to figure out longitude. Latitude is pretty easy. Longitude was difficult. The Polynesians did not need to know that system of extreme, of knowing exactly where the time at any given moment on the ocean where they were, because of this system they had where, you know, where spatial events were defined just in relation to where islands were based on where you were.
So Cook doesn't really pay much attention, but there's another Australian adventurer a little after that time, a guy by the name of David Lewis, who is determined to figure this out. And he comes in contact with another Polynesian navigator named Tavake.
Yeah.
And he has this relationship. He's like, I'm going to learn this. Cook disregarded it. I want to figure it out. Tell us about Tavake, because he really wants to learn from him.
Yeah, I mean, Tavake was, you know, grew up in the Caroline Islands, which technically isn't Polynesia, but what Lewis discovered in his travels that he couldn't find anyone in what we consider Polynesia that could actually teach this, you know, really teach him the ancient ways of navigating. But he found Tavake, and it's, you know, in basically the same region, still in the Pacific. And what happened with Lewis is that he sailed with Tavake for a long time and learned all these methods of navigating, but there was something he felt that he still was not quite getting.
Yeah.
And Tavake died before Lewis could really figure out what that was. And what he wasn't getting was that thing I was talking about before, this idea of navigating by means of reference islands that you conceive of as floating instead of just being stationary. And what makes that really difficult, I talk about it more in the book, but what makes it really difficult is that system, which is called ATAC, does not give you any new navigational information. In other words, you need the stars, you need those other things to figure out what your route is, but it lets you figure out a way of conceiving where you are.
Yeah.
You know, it's a route doesn't mean anything unless you can figure out at any given moment roughly where you are on that route. So, you know, and that's what the system did. And it really saddened Lewis, because not only did he lose a friend, but he felt like he lost this last attempt to understand how these people managed to figure out, you know, managed to navigate through these hundreds or thousands of miles in the age before what we consider a natural way of navigating with GPS or compasses or maps or sextants.
The thing that struck me about it, and why I think it's so relevant in the way you tell the story about the implications of GPS, is that it seems like the navigators of that time were so engaged in the environment around them that they had this intuitive way of perceiving their place in space.
Yeah.
And there's this part of the book where you talk about how they would use wave systems. They would understand the wave systems, and they would read the swells. And there's this part that was so crazy. You say the navigator might even at times squat in the canoe, dragging his testicles on the floor to feel the vibrations. I mean, just the sense of an awareness of movement and space that seems so apart from us these days.
Yeah. It's a sort of a level of situational awareness that we can hardly conceive of. And in a way, that's because, not only because of GPS, but GPS is sort of in a way the last link of things that have been invented that pretty much free us from having that kind of situational awareness or needing to have it.
Explain, give me a sense of how you're seeing the difference between the sort of self-centering that where we are now and that more all-encompassing knowledge used by Polynesian navigators. Because you say that the modern way of doing this provides the possibility of omniscience, which gets us to the implications, which we'll talk about. But we've essentially looked away in some ways, like Cook did, really.
Yeah, it's basically exactly right. We've looked away because we just don't have to have that kind of awareness. I mean, you know, basically, when I say self-centered, I mean it's only defined in terms of where we are now, and that can be very seductive because we tend to think that that's all we need to know at any moment, and we don't even need to really figure out that much because GPS does it for us. So, I mean, the big irony of GPS is that it's this technology that supposedly makes it impossible to get lost. But what it's done instead is it's in a way created new ways of getting lost.
Greg Milner is with us. His book is Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're considering the reach and the effect of GPS, the Global Positioning System, which, of course, is everywhere. Greg Milner has written a book that tells the history of GPS, which he describes as a story of human ingenuity, but he says it's also come with a price. The book is called Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. He's joining us from a studio in New York City. So you write about, you were mentioning the importance of trying to get a decent chronometer so they could figure out longitude. And, of course, then comes John Harrison, that clockmaker who develops the first marine chronometer. That was a big deal. Then you also write about the atomic clock, which in some ways is the idea of time, the connection, how did you put it in the book? This idea, you say, of the question of where you are would always be conjoined with the question of when. So, so clock, time is a crucial part. And the atomic clock is just another way of thinking of that, I guess.
Yeah, and then figuring out a way to put the atomic clock on satellites was sort of in a way that it would still keep good time was the equivalent of trying to figure out a way to put a clock on the open ocean in a way that it would still keep good time. I mean, it was substituting one frontier for the other. I mean, because basically, you know, real briefly, the way GPS works is, like I said, you need to be able to time how long the signals it takes to get between the satellite and you.
Yep.
You do that with one satellite, and you can figure out how far away the satellite is because the signal is traveling traveling at a constant speed, the speed of light. If you can do that with four satellites simultaneously, you can figure out how far away you are from those four satellites and extrapolate from that information latitude, longitude, and altitude, as well as knowing the exact time. And so that's what I mean. Like, there's the concept of where is always, always, always wrapped up in the concept of when. Yeah. They're basically inseparable.
The atomic clock, you said, offered a change from something governed by behavior outside the clock to something located within the clock. That was that was a big deal.
Right, because it was just based on, you know, the decay of atoms as opposed to the movement of celestial bodies.
I love the story, the Naval Research Laboratory, that just the amount of work that they put into, you know, where we've sort of ended up in terms of GPS is remarkable.
Yeah.
Say something about that era. This was kind of in the 1970s. It was during the Cold War, of course, and this sort of arms race really kicks in, where you have us and you have the Soviets working on these different satellite-based navigation ideas. Talk about that give and take, how that played out.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about it is that nobody was really paying that much attention. I mean, GPS really was developed ultimately, you know, by the Air Force, a joint program office that included members of all the services, but really the Air Force, beginning in 1973. And throughout the 70s and 80s, the Air Force itself tried to kill its own program on several occasions. So it was almost like there maybe was this arms race, because at the same time, Russia was developing GLONASS, which today is still the only system that rivals GPS in terms of being having both a full global coverage and a complete satellite constellation. But back then, it's almost like nobody was paying attention, because the Air Force didn't even understand, by and large, why it was developing GPS to begin with.
Yeah. And they figured what the brass were saying at the time was, look, we don't need another navigation system. But as somebody points out, it's not really a navigation system. It's a guidance system.
Right. That was a point that a lot of the early GPS people tried to make. I mean, if there's one person who deserves the title of godfather of GPS, and there's several people who could say that they could have that claim, it's really Brad Parkinson. And Brad went to Vietnam. He was in the Air Force, and he was a brilliant guy. And he was sickened by how he saw the air campaigns being conducted in Vietnam, how just they were so imprecise, and it really, really saddened him, the way he saw it, that the Air Force hadn't learned anything since World War II. They were still doing carpet bombing. And so he had this image of a system that could, as he put it, drop five bombs in the same hole.
Yeah.
And that was, in fact, he even put it up on the wall of his office when he got the GPS program going. You know, the purpose of this office is to figure out a way to drop five bombs in the same hole. And that's how GPS began, really. It's a way to bomb things more precisely so that you could drop bombs in a way that hit exactly where you wanted them to hit. And that's what they mean by it's like a guidance system. That was the point that, I mean, you could use it for navigation, but that was one of the ways that people like Parkinson would try to sell the program, is to try to get people to see this subtle but very important distinction.
Did Parkinson have a sense of the potential for something like this? I mean, once, and we'll come back to this, but once civilian life sort of catches hold of the potential for something like this, it really takes off.
Yeah.
Did Brad Parkinson have a sense of, you know, and I'm guessing it's the same thing like the people who discovered the internet, who would have known?
Yeah.
Did he have any idea about that?
He did. And, you know, part of the thing was from the earliest beginnings, GPS had to have a civilian component. That was one of the prerequisites for its funding. But Parkinson was and still is a brilliant guy, and the people he worked with were brilliant. But none of them could have foreseen how much GPS would become entrenched in civilian life. I mean, for one thing, back then a GPS receiver was this desktop environment that involved also a lot, you know, this big bulky thing that involved a lot of post-processing. Nobody could foresee that it would one day be in a tiny little chip and you'd be able to get these incredibly accurate readings in real time. So he saw it, but nobody could foresee how much it's become a part of civilian life.
When the military finally figures out that this system could be useful is during, it's amazing, Desert Storm. It took that long for them to kind of figure this out. And there's a man named Buster Glosson, who's one of the characters at this part of the story, who's tasked with planning the Desert Storm air campaign.
Yeah.
Talk about him.
Well, he like a lot of people involved in GPS, like Brad Parkinson himself, he was very, very influenced by his time in Vietnam and was very disillusioned by the way the air campaign was. So he was aware of GPS because I think he'd been involved in a committee that would approve special projects in the Pentagon. And so he'd been keeping track of how it was being it was being developed. So when his boss before the Gulf War started, Chuck Horner, who planned the air campaign, tasked Glasson with really planning the nuts and bolts of it. Glasson figured out that he wanted to, that there was a way to start the war with GPS by having these special forces copters equipped with GPS lead army helicopters into battle, because they could make sure that they were dropping them, that they were going on exactly the right course, essentially. And he was, that was a big thing, especially for Schwarzkopf, who was an army guy, General Schwarzkopf, to have the army being led into battle. But Schwarzkopf was also, a Vietnam vet, and he understood how much GPS could actually make that beginning of the war safer for the people who were dropping the bombs.
Yeah. And GPS, what you say, was probably one of the primary reasons Desert Storm ended so quickly.
I would say it's the reason that the war ended so quickly and so decisively. I mean, the main way that GPS's influence was felt in Desert Storm was in the ground campaign. It allowed the Americans and their allies to basically barnstorm across the desert, and the Iraqis did not expect that at all. They thought that the featurelessness of the desert would make it very difficult for them to navigate, and they would stick to roads. And instead, because they had made a whole series of they had plotted points with GPS in the weeks before the war began across the desert, they could just tear across it with very little effort at all. And so it just completely overwhelmed the Iraqi army. And so, GPS was the reason, I think, that the Gulf War was such an overwhelming victory for the Americans.
One sort of, maybe it's a side note, and maybe I'm making too much of it, but you write that for Buster Glasson, faith was big.
Yeah.
And maybe it was just sort of religious faith, but it seems to me that it's like one of the subtexts for this book is this idea of the faith we put in systems. Is that making too much of the idea?
No, absolutely. I think that I think that people like Glasson probably almost saw GPS, almost in religious terms, in the power it could wield and how effective it could be to, for their side of the war. I mean, he was a religious guy, and I really think he probably almost, I wouldn't be surprised if he saw GPS in almost religious terms.
Yeah. You're right. GPS is pretty much entrenched in the military, of course. But one of the things that's so interesting is the way it's often used, or maybe even mostly used by troops on the ground, is in their iPhone.
Yeah.
Which kind of leads us to the idea of how the civilian world has taken hold of this technology. How does it get adapted into civilian life? How does that work?
Well, like you said, it's interesting you brought that up, because one of the ways to illustrate how much GPS began as a military application and now is more a civilian application. I mean, civilian applications overwhelm the military applications at this point. And one of the ways that's played out is that soldiers in the field like to use their iPhones and iPads to get position fixes. These are soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. Because they, in a way, are more useful than the military grade receivers, which, because of military requirements, aren't as flexible as these civilian ones. Yeah, I mean, essentially now there is almost no facet of modern life that isn't in some ways touched by GPS on the civilian level. I mean, it controls the entire transportation infrastructure in one way or another, from guiding ships in the ports to guiding the cargo on those ports, to landing planes of all sizes. But it's also, because of its timekeeping abilities, it's become an important part of just about every complex system in the world, including the nodes of the internet.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in how these serious but amateur sailors, guys like the person who founded Chuck E. Cheese, pizza stuff, and William F. Buckley, I mean, how important it was to sailors.
Yeah.
it all seems to come back to the sea in some ways.
Yeah,
the story.
Buckley was one of the, it's a funny thing about him, this man who, what his goal was to stand athwart history and yell stop, was one of the biggest proponents of GPS, and found out about it before anyone else, and actually befriended one of the earliest GPS entrepreneurs, Javad Ashjai, who was an Iranian man who fled after the revolution. And, you know, Buckley saw it in such an inspiring story. And yeah, Buckley, you know, was a very, very serious sailor, and he quickly recognized how useful GPS could be out on the open ocean. But yeah, it was the mariners who were some of the first people to adapt it. Not the first people, but some of the earliest ones.
Yeah. Greg Milner is with us. His book is called Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. We'll take another brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Greg Milner. We're talking about his book, it traces the history and the effects of GPS. It's called Pinpoint. He's joining us from a studio in New York City. Well, there are a lot of these kinds of stories, but let's talk about one in particular. Albert and his wife, Rita, from British Columbia. They this was in 2011, and they're headed to Albert has this conference he's going to in Las Vegas. They're in British Columbia, so they jump in the Astro van, and they have one of those Magellan systems, and they get lost on their way to. You mentioned this search effort involves police agencies in four states, 3,000 miles. They can't find this couple.
Yeah, nobody knew where they had gone because they hadn't told anyone the route they were taking. They were kind of playing it by ear, and they were using regular paper map, but at some point they decided to take a more scenic route, and they figured there would be a way to cut back over to the main highway where they needed to be. When that was not forthcoming, they decided to turn to GPS, which then guided them deep into, you know, some of the most remote backcountry in the United States, an area where their van was just not designed to go, and they got into trouble.
Do you want to say what happens? Is that giving too much away?
Well, I'll say this.
You don't have to, by the way. No, I know. People can read the book and figure out what happens to them.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this. They basically vanished into thin air, and were stuck way out in the middle of nowhere. Albert decided to go off, you know, trying to make it on foot to what seemed to be the nearest town. Took the GPS unit with him, which was designed to run off a car battery, so it probably died almost immediately. And Albert, you know, he did not make it to town. I'll put it that way.
Right.
Rita was left where they were stranded. And the Rita story is a little bit more unique in terms of she was a victim of death by GPS in a way that turned out to be somewhat unexpected.
Yeah.
I'll put it that way.
Yeah. But there are dozens and dozens of stories of people just ending up in the wrong place or way off the mark. And you say these stories, you see them in the news and we laugh at them. It's like, really? You turned right into the ocean or whatever? Yeah. But you say that something is really going on. Something is, in fact, happening to us. Explain what you – we'll get to Edward Tolman here in a moment, but generally – we're losing part of ourselves, is how you put it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You mentioned faith before, and what you hear with a lot of these death by GPS incidents, and like I said, I include death by GPS to mean not just literal death, or maybe not even just serious injury, but just incidents where people, like you said, turn right into a river because the GPS said turn right here, is that oftentimes these people, it's strikingly similar, the statements they give to police or reporters, which is always along the lines of, the GPS told me to do it. You know, it said it would navigate a route. They provide they kind of grant this agency to their GPS units that's pretty striking that we don't normally do with modern technology. We say, like, it told me it would do this, and it didn't. And it's the only word, really, is faith. People put their faith in it. But, you know, like I said, it's easy to laugh at these people, but any one of us who's used GPS in a strange area knows how seductive it can be just to let that soothing voice tell us where to go.
This is where we bring into the story a man named Edward Tolman. He's a UC Berkeley psychology professor who, this is in 1948, when he's sort of getting to the end of his career, and he publishes this remarkable paper. It's called Cognitive Maps in Rats and Men.
Yeah.
Talk about that, because Tolman believes that the work that he was doing would essentially help humans explain how they orient themselves in the world.
Yeah. I mean, Tolman was, you know, he was one of those psychologists who did a lot of experiments with rats and mazes. And what he was trying to do in that paper was argue against one school of thought called stimulus response, which held that the way a rat finds its way through a maze is basically by a series of stimuli and responses, meaning that it starts to learn, like, okay, right, when I went here, I came to a dead end, but when I went there, eventually I came to something that, you know, I came to cheese.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't really have a sense of where it is in relation to everything else. It just kind of remembers this way felt good, that way didn't feel good. And so it forges a sense of a series of connections in its brain. What Tolman was saying is that they're actually a lot better, that they're doing something a lot more complex. They're forming a cognitive map. Mm-hmm. They're figuring out where they know where they are in relation to that reward. And the more that they run the map, the more they get, they expand that cognitive map. If you can imagine, like, eventually they're a sense of the way we are when we look down at a paper map, they get that bird's eye view of the maze. And Tolman was arguing that's the way people navigated too. And I mean, interesting, because for him the cognitive map was this very broad idea that essentially was a stand-in for broad-based knowledge of the world, and that's why he thought it was important to try to figure out to explain how it was that we moved from one place to another. We did what rats did. We got a cognitive map in our mind, and we built on it, and we spent our lives building it up.
Yeah. Of course, he died before GPS technology was developed, but in his paper, it's interesting, he worried about the, as he put it, the frustrating conditions that could narrow our cognitive maps. I want to read this. He said, my only answer is to preach the virtues of reason, as you paraphrase him here in the book, preach the virtues of reason and pray that conditions favorable to their development will prevail, as he puts it, across the great God-given maze, which is our human world.
Yeah. He saw the world as a maze, and he really identified with, he was an interesting guy. He really identified with his rats, because the way he saw it, we were all rats trying to figure out our maze, and in the pursuit of science itself was like running a maze. You always get more closer and closer to the truth. You never find the ultimate truth. You're still in a replica of the world, the maze, but you're always just getting closer and closer. And so, yeah, he saw things like, for example, Southern racism as being example of narrowing cognitive maps as a way of just not seeing the broader picture.
Has anyone confirmed the idea that this idea of not seeing the world in a larger context is drawing us inward, making us more, you know, small-minded, racist, big? Is anyone confirming these ideas?
I think, well, it's a difficult thing to confirm, because as Tolman was the first to point out, he was talking somewhat symbolically, and since then there's been disputes over what the cognitive map actually is,
right,
where, you know, some people see it almost as the brain being a literal map, and that you can point to what the parts of it that are doing navigation and whatnot, but it's largely a symbolic construct, and that's the most useful way to look at it. So it's a difficult thing to prove, but it's a very, very useful way to look at the world and how we define the way we act in it, the way, not just the way we move, but the way we interact with the world.
You write about some of the modern day developments in cognitive science that could be relevant in the age of GPS. And one of these things is this disorder I wanted to ask you about, called developmental topographical disorientation.
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, it's essentially people who, it's pretty rare, who really have no sense of direction whatsoever, who they really, they can do a route that they've followed, you know, hundreds of times in their life, they still might have a problem with it. And so the idea is that they have a very, very narrow cognitive map, that they rely on more on stimulus response. And to some degree, we all rely on both, but most of us, you know, have a somewhat developed cognitive map, and people with this disorder, which is just, I think the disorder was just coined about 10 years ago or so, the name of it, they really, it's almost like they can't form cognitive maps. They just can't do it.
But is part of the concern that we're all going to have that disorder if we keep relying on something? I mean, I know you don't want to overstate it, and you're very temperate and careful about all of that, but that is one of the things that comes up, a concern,
right? Well,
anyway.
I mean, I think a good way to demonstrate it is this. You know, a lot of people probably know about that study of London cab drivers several years ago that was done, that showed, because they have to memorize so many routes and streets and points of interest before they can get their licenses, that they found that the parts of their hippocampus that are responsible for navigation and spatial awareness actually get bigger. One thing that wasn't reported as much because the results were that were a little bit more tentative is that they've also discovered that when these people retire, that part of their brain, you know, shrinks back because they're not using that as much anymore. So, you know, one of the neuroscientists I spoke with who was involved in the study said he thinks it's certainly possible that GPS could be having a similar effect on people. I mean, once you have to use that level of that mode of navigation less, it's very possible that that could actually be shrinking that part of your brain. And so, yeah, it's a very real possibility.
I want to go back to that photo that you mentioned from Google Maps, the Street View archive that you first saw. This was back in 2009. It really had an effect on you, and you sort of wanted to track it down.
I became kind of obsessed with it.
Yeah, why do you think?
It just seemed like there was this. I mean, it's a striking photo for one thing. It's almost perfectly framed, and it just happens that the Google car was driving by at that moment. You know, it takes a photo every couple seconds, I think, and it just struck me like, how can we see this person that we can tell something very dramatic has happened, but and we know it struck me that we can tell exactly where he is largely because of GPS, but that doesn't tell us anything about the context of it, which is, the more I learned about it, seemed to be kind of a metaphor for GPS in general, as being able to tell us a lot about one aspect of things while leaving open a lot of other aspects of it. And so, yeah, I decided that I wanted to solve the mystery of who this man was. And again, I won't give it away.
Yeah, don't.
But, you know, I discovered some things and still some other things are a mystery.
But you write that these systems, like these geographic information systems, offer, here's how you put it, an actively mediated representation of the world.
Yeah.
It constructs its own version of the world, not a mirror image of reality. What are you getting at there, that it's a different reality than...
Well, put it this way, okay, and you know what a geographical information system is, a GIS, is really that's, unlike GPS, it's not a specific technology. It's more the combination of cartography and database management and computer science that allows for deep maps. Google Maps is a perfect example. And the way most of us experience GPS is through GIS, through geographical information systems like Google Maps. In the past, it would just GPS units would just give you latitude and longitude, and that would tell you almost, it would be very not useful for us. And so these geographic information systems rely on a model of the Earth that may not, that is a close approximation of the actual Earth, but is not the same thing. It's a model that's used because it's useful for us as a means of calculating. And so that's what I mean. I mean, when we look at something like Google Maps, we're looking through a whole lot of hidden systems that are defining what the world is and where things are in relation to other things. But it's not like these things are natural or neutral. I mean, Google Maps, for example, relies on a model of the Earth that's actually pretty different from the way the shape of the Earth is. Yeah. They compute things based on a sphere, which the Earth is not. But it's easier to compute things and then kind of shift them over to so that they're more or less accurate than it is to. It'd be a lot more difficult for Google Maps to compute based on the weird shape of the Earth as it actually is. So that's something ultimately that I think GPS is, you know, we should keep in mind when we use it, that we're looking through a lot of different mediated systems. This isn't giving us some sort of natural neutral answer about things like where we are.
Yeah. You also write about the implications of technologies that can do such intimate monitoring of people around the world. And you say that it's a blank slate onto which we project our desires, and our desires tend to be where people are and what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, real briefly, two of the biggest parts of fastest growing parts of the GPS economy are, first of all, precision agriculture, which is basically using GPS-based systems to grow food more efficiently, and it's a multi-billion dollar industry at this point. The other is what's called fleet management, and that's a polite euphemism for GPS tracking. Pretty much every company now that has a fleet of cars, or government agencies that have fleets of vehicles, now employs some sort of fleet management system. And it's not like GPS was designed to do that. I mean, GPS tracker is essentially a GPS receiver attached to some sort of communication device like a cell phone. And every few seconds or whatever, that cell phone is calling back to the central person, to the boss, and saying, this is the GPS coordinates the last time I looked. And there's no way, I guarantee you, that people like Brad Parkinson ever thought that this is what GPS would be used for.
Right.
It just would not have come to it. But, and yet, this is really what we've decided to use it for, whether it's tracking bosses tracking their workers, or tracking animals, or tracking dementia patients, or tracking, you know, criminals, or people we think are criminals, which is causing a whole lot of consternation in the criminal justice system about the legality of this sort of thing. We've decided, by and large, that what we want GPS to do is keep track of where everything is in the world at any given moment, including human beings.
And we're just now beginning, you say, to confront the consequences of all of this. But it seems like one of the takeaways from the book is that, look, we're in charge. We can figure this out. I mean, GPS, you say, reflects is a choice. It's a conscious application of a neutral technology. Say something about that, finally.
Well, ultimately, you know, it's actually kind of difficult to define what GPS is. I mean, the definition I gave earlier about the three segments is still somewhat opaque. But if you really want to get down to it, what GPS is, it's just a radio signal. It's a radio signal like the signal that people listening to this are hearing right now. And that's what I mean by neutral and a blank slate. It really is just a signal that the Air Force gives to us. And it's funny, if you go to Schriever, they're very, very clear on this point that once the signal leaves the satellite, their work is done. We can do whatever it is that we want with it. And in fact, the specs of GPS are public record so that people can design things that use the GPS signal. We've decided to take this signal and to do certain things with it. And that's what I mean by a neutral thing. All it is a radio signal that we're receiving. We're not even transmitting anything to the satellites, by the way. It's purely passive in the sense that all we have to do is receive it. But it's just a very, very, very faint pulse. It barely exists by the time it reaches Earth. It's amazing we can even use it to do information processing and get information from it. But it's purely a blank, neutral slate.
Greg Milner, his book is Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. Joined us from a studio in New York. Greg, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me on.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.